Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the popular media narrative is that countries led by women are performing better with COVID. But is this really true? And if so, what are the reasons? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Since the outbreak of COVID-19, national governments have shown distinctly different approaches with different levels of success. But it appears that nations led by women have a better record than their male counterparts. On today's show, we explore these successes and explore the research being conducted to try to explain why. Our guests today are Leah Windsor, Research Assistant Professor in the Institute for Intelligent Systems at the University of Memphis. She's the co-author of Women Leaders and COVID-19 Fatalities, along with two other of our guests, as well as The Language of Radicalization, Female Internet Recruitment to Participation in ISIS Activities. Gina Yanatel Reinhardt is Associate Professor of Government at the University of Essex in the UK. She is the author of The Intersectionality of Disaster Effects on Trust in Public Officials. Jennifer Piscopo is Associate Professor of Politics at Occidental College. She is the author of Women Leaders and Pandemic Performance, A Spurious Correlation. And Courtney Burns is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Bucknell University. She is the author of Signaling Women and Leaders, Navigating the Double Bind as Foreign Policy Decision Maker. Thank you all for joining us. Leah Windsor, I'm going to start with you. In the introduction, I had said that countries led by women leaders seem to be doing better than their male counterparts. What are the measurements that indicate that they actually are performing better?
Well, that's a complicated story, and it's certainly been the popular media common narrative that women leaders have done better than men leaders in not having as many COVID-related fatalities. But using empirical data on COVID fatalities, we show that there's not a whole lot of difference between men and women leaders, at least in the number of casualties. But this also means that we may be looking too myopically at how well world leaders are doing during the COVID crisis, that, you know, still being in the thick of it, there may be real meaningful gendered differences between leaders and societies. In economic recovery and social resilience and things like that. So we really challenge the common narrative that women leaders have done better. Now, that's just in a quantitative sense. There's good evidence that there are real qualitative differences between women and men leaders in the world.
Thank you. Gina Reinhardt, it looks like at least part of your research is that women leaders aren't doing as well as male counterparts, or at least it hasn't necessarily been proven, but certainly some of the narratives. I think of New Zealand as an example and their level of success and Germany's level of success. That's what's being reported. Is it that you haven't been able to necessarily show that the level of success has been greater? Or is it just we get these common media narratives and you're trying to kind of pull that apart and suggest that maybe the media is taking too simple of an approach?
Really, it seems like the media narrative is too simple. We do have quite a bit of data and the ability to test a variety of things. And what we found in this paper and in some of our other work is that women tend to give speeches better, and they tend to be better at making people feel better. So their populations are feeling much more comforted and resolved, and as though they are working hard and they're able to follow what's being told to them. And the media is not focusing on the male-led countries that are doing a very good job with the pandemic. Vietnam is doing a very good job with the pandemic. There are several other male-led countries that are doing quite well. These female-led countries, Iceland and New Zealand, are also reaping the benefit of being very advanced economically and socially, very highly developed countries, Germany as well. New Zealand and Iceland also have the benefit of being islands that can cut off a lot of their incoming traffic that might be bringing pandemic with them. And what we find is that countries that are more likely to elect women are also more likely to do better in the pandemic. And so it's these cultural features of countries, whether they are led by men or women, that are making them do better in the pandemic. And however, when they're led by women, they do even better in the pandemic. So having a woman leader is better, but it really depends on having a country and a culture that is willing to accept the type of leadership that a woman is more likely to give. Once you're in that place, then women-led countries do better. If you're just looking at countries that are unlikely to elect women or that don't have these common features, then their women leaders and men leaders have no difference.
So Jennifer, I understand that your research, kind of similar to the other research, are finding these correlations a bit more spurious, although I know your approach has tended to focus more on the legislatures, if I understand that correctly. How important is gender composition among legislators in comparison, for instance, to whether or not the executive, whether or not the president or the prime minister is a woman? How important are those different variables?
Sure. I'm happy to talk about that. You know, my previous research has really looked at the role of women legislators and public policy, but my peer-reviewed published piece on women leaders and pandemic performance actually did look at women executives. And so this piece came out over the summer in Politics and Gender, and it was exactly in response to this media narrative that Leah and Gina have highlighted. And one thing I noticed looking at this media narrative was that the media was pulling out examples that mixed women who were heads of government and women who are heads of state. So that's an important distinction for political scientists, right? So heads of state are like the Queen of England. They play more ceremonial roles. Many countries actually have a dual executive, right? Where they have a head of government and then they have a head of state who plays these more ceremonial functions. If we narrow the universe down to just countries where women are heads of government, there's only about 12 countries right now where women are heads of government, right? So women heads of states are important for all kinds of reasons, but we wouldn't expect them to have the kinds of policy powers that would be influential in a pandemic. So first, what I did in this article was narrow the focus to women heads of government, these 12 or so women. And then I thought about exactly as Gina and Leah discussed, nine of those women are governing what I call in the article high capacity countries. These are wealthy, industrialized countries, predominantly in Western Europe and Scandinavia, though we can include Taiwan in that group, right? And that these are countries that we would expect would have the state capacity, the government capacity to perform well in a pandemic. And indeed, when I looked at a variety of factors, such as the bureaucratic capacity, the bureaucratic impartialness of countries led by women, I also looked at levels of citizen trust in government, because we think citizens need to trust their governments in a pandemic to follow their government's suggestions about masking and social distancing. And I found that all of these countries outperformed their peers on these metrics. So my argument about a spurious correlation was it's actually right now, high capacity countries are more likely to elect women and also more likely to perform better in the pandemic. But the causal factor is being a high capacity country. Now it's true that women leaders could also be more likely to invest in making their countries effective, making their governments effective and rebuilding citizen trust. We have evidence from elsewhere in the literature that is true, but these kinds of metrics that I looked at, citizen trust in government, investment in the welfare sector, impartial bureaucracies, they take decades to build. So it's not just that you had a woman leader, she came in, she shored up the bureaucracy, and now the pandemic performance is better. Countries are diverging in their paths. And it's very interesting that right now, high capacity countries are more likely to elect women. That wasn't always the pattern. It used to be that global South countries were more likely to elect women leaders. Lastly, on the legislature, just to say, I haven't looked at the legislature and COVID-19 performance directly, but other scholars have not found a relationship between the proportion of women legislators and COVID-19 mortality, though they have found some evidence of the proportion of women legislators being related to early school closures and stay-at-home measures.
And Courtney Burns, I guess this is partially a lesson that the media doesn't always learn, that I know we always teach our students that correlation does not equal causation, and other factors can certainly play a role. Are there other factors that you would highlight as to why it appears on the surface that women leaders are doing a better job, but maybe there's something else going on.
I think it's really important to highlight the role of stereotypes. So we were really quick to pick up on women doing a good job because of stereotypes that women are caring and compassionate and, you know, care about people at a different rate or better rate than, say, men leaders. And so there's certainly this narrative. But there were things that kind of fulfilled it as well. For example, Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand gave some speeches, as we kind of hinted at some of our research, gave some speeches that made people feel cared for, talked about the tooth fairy and the bunny and the Easter rabbit and all of these things. And that is a very categorically different take on it than how some of the male leaders have gone about talking to their people about it. And so I think that really endures and makes the media kind of pick up on a story that may not obviously be entirely true. So stereotypes play a really big role in how we view women leaders and potentially how they act. People may be expecting women to respond differently than men as well. And so they may do that in order to appease their voters, as in terms of wanting to stay in power perhaps. So I think the impact of stereotypes is important to understand in terms of women's responses.
Gina Reinhart?
Thanks. So I think that building on Courtney's and Jennifer's points, it's really important to realize that the situation we're talking about is what we call endogenous, in the sense that the leader is a product of their country and a product of their electoral system and the cultures that they represent, right? And so they are giving speeches, for example, that tend to appeal to the people that have elected them. And we, as Jennifer does, we distinguish between heads of state and heads of government. And we define, based on some of Courtney's previous work, we define the head of government as someone who has control over a military, right? So if you are a head of state, you're basically in charge of diplomacy, but you do not have control over your country's military. And so that didn't count, just like Jennifer said, right? That doesn't count as being led by a woman. So it makes sense that Ardern and Merkel and some of the other female leaders spoke to their people the way those people wanted to be spoken to, and in ways that communicated well with those people. And that Ardern, in particular, she gave a really good speech. She gave a few very, very well-written, excellent speeches that were exactly what her people needed to hear, and a lot of other people wanted to hear too. And so that then became the narrative of women doing so much better. But because these women are products of their own systems, right? And they have become politicians and leaders in those systems, it bears repeating that it is these particular cultural traits that are both electing women and making a place a good environment to deal with this pandemic. The ones that we noticed in particular were I'm reminding myself here what some of them were. A more egalitarian way of doing things, I think it was, right? And being on a dimension that's considered feminine versus masculine, being more feminine in general as a culture. And so that seems to really help. And when women are in leadership positions in those countries, like I said, they're doing even better.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about managing and eliminating the coronavirus and what has led to some countries' success and other countries' failures.
Leah Windsor, it seems like at this point we're talking a lot about issues of political communication. And so how important is sort of the frames around which messages are communicated?
So around the issue of framing, I think that this gets at what all of us have been talking around, which is the issue of the gender double bind, where there's this contradiction where women are expected to be feminine but also masculine, and that leadership is generally defined in terms of masculinity because so many world leaders are men. And as it turns out, pandemics are ideal circumstances for women to demonstrate both their masculine leadership qualities, doing things related to, you know, hard security measures like closing borders or enacting quarantines or masking orders or stay-at-home orders, you know, acting stately and you know, enacting restrictions within society, but it also allows them to fulfill the stereotypes that Courtney was talking about with their feminine leadership, you know, showing compassion and caring and, you know, connecting more humanely with people. You know, I think it was the leader of Norway that did a special session for children, you know, saying that this might be scary, but we're going to get through this. And, you know, in so many ways, women are penalized, not just women leaders, but women in general are penalized for going against type. So if you're too strong or too authoritative, or you're aggressive, you're not showing initiative, right? But the pandemics are really these ideal circumstances where women can showcase both their feminine and masculine leadership qualities. The other thing that I wanted to say was about the legislatures, because we did look at that as well, because legislatures are part of the system of governance too. And we were not encouraged because we found that the more women in the legislatures, the worse outcomes the societies had in terms of COVID-related fatalities. And we've really puzzled over this a lot because it's counter to the narrative of women leadership. And so we're thinking about this in a couple ways. The first is that there are some societies where women are represented more in the legislatures, as Gina was saying too, because of endogenous circumstances.
So we've lost Leah Windsor, but Courtney Burns, could you finish her thought for her?
Sure. So in our research, we were trying to figure out what was going on with national legislatures having more women, but not necessarily decreasing COVID deaths. And the endogenous factors are these things about societies. Some societies have gender quotas, which means that they have high rates of representation, but that doesn't necessarily signal in society that, as Jennifer kind of phrased them, these high impact countries. And so that could be a factor going on. You have countries like Rwanda, which is the number one country in terms of women in the legislature, but they might not be the type of country you think of with the best infrastructure in place to prevent death. On the other hand, you have countries with high rates of women in legislatures that are more egalitarian. And these are some of the countries where we see also women leaders. And so in those regards, you do see some benefit, but it's not necessarily the legislature side of it that's the benefit.
Jennifer Piscopo?
So I want to go back to the stereotypes, but I'll pick up on this thread of women in legislatures. I think it's really important that we keep in mind where policymaking around the pandemic is happening. So across the board, we see policymaking on the pandemic being made by executives. So chief executives, health ministries, they're making the decisions around how the countries are going to contain the pandemic. And legislatures have actually been fairly isolated in this process. And for instance, my co-author and I, Susan Franciscat, and I have done a survey of state legislators and city councilors in the United States about gender and COVID. And we're actually hearing from a lot of them on open-ended comments in the survey and in our interviews that they're frustrated by the fact that executives, whether we're talking about chief executives or governors or mayors, are really bypassing legislative bodies, and that legislatures are doing a lot of constituent service, but they're not necessarily engaged in policymaking around the pandemic. So I want us to be not so quick to say that there's no reason not to have women in the legislature because it doesn't matter for the pandemic, because the dynamics of pandemic policymaking are really different. This relates to another point about which is not what my colleagues were saying at all. I just want to flag that because this relates to another a comment I wanted to make going back to the gender and the stereotypes. I think one of the reasons the media narrative around women executives and pandemic performance really attracted so much attention was confounded stereotypical explanations about masculinity being concentrated in the chief executive. As my colleagues on the call have pointed out, all of a sudden, feminine qualities in the chief executive seemed more valuable in a pandemic because, of course, a pandemic needs compassion and empathy. It doesn't need military bluster, right? You can't nuke the virus. But I think that these narratives were offered by pundits and journalists in good faith. You know, there's a constant idea that we should have more women in office. And often that idea is motivated in good faith, but problematically on this ground that women are different and that the reasons we should support more women in office is not just because it's just and fair, but because women are sort of essentially different in some ways that are better for politics. And so this media narrative was so attractive because it seemed to confirm this idea that the reason you should support women is because women are quote unquote better. That's the same sort of idea. You should have more women in the legislature because then policy will be better. I think we have to be skeptical about this narrative because I actually think it creates a double-edged sword for women, that when they turn out not to be better, right, then there seems to be no reason for having them there. And we don't ask men to justify their presence in politics on the ground that they are essentially different or that they are essentially better. And we also know that when women are in office during a crisis, this is different than coming to power during a crisis. We can talk about that in a moment. But we also know that when women are in office during a crisis, whether in the executive or the legislature, they are disproportionately likely to lose their seats for failing to turn that crisis around relative to men because they're disproportionately punished for failing to be better. So often these narratives about women leaders are really offered by people who, like me, who are deeply committed to wanting to see more women in office. But I think as scholars, we have to be skeptical about this better narrative because it seems to be beneficial, but it can also have some really serious consequences.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Courtney Burns, you had made a reference to the glass cliff. I have to admit, that's the first time I've heard that phrase. Could you explain that a bit to me?
I was thinking about it as Jennifer was speaking, and it's a little different as she kind of alluded to when she was talking, is it's a glass cliff has been primarily discussed so far in relation to women CEOs. So companies that are struggling appoint a woman or a person of color because it's different and it's a different perspective. However, when they fail to turn it around, if they do, because it's already a very difficult situation, there's further to fall, basically. And so this can be very, very bad for women or people of color because it's like, oh, see, women aren't capable or people of color aren't capable. And so it made me think about this in terms of women during times of crisis or emergency or during a pandemic. If they fail, there's more to lose for women because the entire sex can be blamed instead of, you know, one person potentially making bad choices regardless of whether they're a man or a woman. When men make bad choices, we don't often blame them because they're men. We blame them because they made, you know, different policy choices. So that is why I kind of made that off reference to the glass cliff. One of the things that came to mind when we were talking about the legislatures and all of this was one of the things that I think thinking forward in terms of where research might go or things that we might be interested in paying attention to going forward with legislature. So yes, more women in legislatures aren't necessarily decreasing COVID deaths as Jennifer mentioned, but I think there are gonna be some long-term things that we're gonna wanna be on the lookout for in terms of policy changes that occur, whether it's done at the executive level or the legislative level pursued by women. I think that there could be some real changes going forward. And so I'm kind of interested to see what some of those long-term changes might be.
You know, Reinhardt?
Thanks, Doug. So I think that is a fascinating avenue of inquiry as well. And we are going to see a lot of changes based on this pandemic, right? I actually come to this as someone who I began by studying disasters and resilience and emergency management and hazards governance. We're going to see a lot of changes about this pandemic. It's going to be very interesting, or based on the pandemic, it's going to be really interesting to see what that means for women. And I want to highlight a piece that some colleagues had recently, Tiffany Barnes and Maria Holman, who have found, they were investigating women in legislatures, because in a lot of countries, there have been quotas imposed of a certain threshold of women that must be elected to the National Legislative Assembly. And we should expect women to represent all parts of a political spectrum. We should expect women to have all types of skills and priorities. And what that means is that in countries where women are elected largely due to quotas, parties of all kinds, parties that we might not expect to actually support women, are going to put forth women candidates because they need to. And that muddies the waters, just like Jennifer was suggesting, right? It muddies the waters. We shouldn't be expecting women to have a particular profile just because they're women. And when they don't, because they were elected based on their party leanings and their ideology, then we say, oh, women didn't do what women were supposed to do. Women didn't represent the ideas that women are supposed to represent. They weren't womanly enough or feminine enough or feminist enough. And in the end, like we've all said, nobody says that men weren't men enough, and that that's why that they're not getting elected again, or that's why things are going wrong in the country. But that's what we place on women. And there's lots of reasons why we shouldn't.
So the pandemic has, for me, reminded me of what I think is one of the more compelling distinctions between a feminine and a masculine approach to governance. The idea that the sort of masculine approach in the middle of a crisis like a pandemic is the responsibility to protect, and the sort of protection motif, versus the more feminine approach that I know feminist scholars refer to as care ethics, you know, this ethics of care. And I think of that with respect to the broad question about what exactly should be the role of governments in these sorts of circumstances, and how that certainly plays both to gender stereotypes, but broadly to issues of a masculinist versus feminist approach. Leah Windsor, I'd love your thoughts on that question. Am I onto something here? And is this something that you could see potentially developing as a result of the pandemic?
Well, you know, the way that I've been thinking about it is in terms of the language that men and women leaders use, and whether or not that goes against type, or if it's what we would expect. And so in the communication that men and women leaders have used, especially, you know, we focused in another paper that Gina and Courtney and I and some others are on the language that around the time that the World Health Organization designated the pandemic, or the COVID virus, a global pandemic, there were many leaders that gave speeches. And so we've looked at these, and as it turns out, the countries led by men tend to use the kind of language that men generally use in terms of grammar and syntax. And the women leaders tend to use language that is in line with what women generally use. So they're not only speaking as world leaders, but they're speaking as men or as women too. So it's there's a real congruence between the way that they're delivering their message and the way that they're governing and the way that they're being perceived.
Yes, Gina.
It's really important to realize how we analyze this from the perspective of the governance of hazards in general. The disaster scholars are pretty well decided that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. In other words, preparing for hazards and planning for critical events like pandemics can go a long way to mitigating the effects of the hazards, right? But we do believe that it is a rather feminine trait to prepare and a much more masculine trait to react. And so and that is the way a lot of countries operate. It is much easier to get funding and attention and approval for reacting to a hazard than it is for spending money preparing for a hazard. Because if you do a really great job preparing, then you never actually have to deal with a disaster. And it's really hard to prove that all of that preparation you did was a good idea because of this nothing, in this example of nothing, right, that you have to deal with. What most countries tend to do is wait until something bad happens and then try to funnel relief and recovery toward that bad thing. And that's what a lot of countries have done in this case too. So the method of dealing with disaster, I think, is conflated with these masculine and feminine traits. And it's things that we tend to reward, politically speaking, in particular ways.
Jennifer Piscopo?
I think we should also, you know, be attentive to how sort of norms and preferences and ideas about masculinity and femininity and governing styles really, in a lot of cases, intersect with partisan identification, right? So I think the United States provides a really fascinating counterpoint to this, because if you look at sort of the masculine performance around President-elect Joe Biden of the Democratic Party, right? I mean, Biden wears a mask. I mean, he sort of exudes empathy and caring, not just around the pandemic, but around other places. That's actually been sort of part of his political brand. You know, I think we could have a conversation whether, you know, a woman could sort of run on empathy the way Biden has ran his campaign or perhaps his political career on empathy. But I think what's interesting is that, you know, Democrats in the United States don't feel that Biden is behaving in an unmasculine way, right? But it's clear that Republicans in the United States are sort of attacking his masculinity when he wears a mask, when he talks about caring and kindness. I think another interesting example, right, is Hawaii, thinking about Gina's comments, right? I mean, Hawaii is the only state in the United States, and perhaps the only entity, my international relations colleagues can let me know, that has issued an explicitly feminist recovery plan around COVID. Hawaii has a male governor, but they're also the most diverse state in the United States. 72% of Hawaiians are have some non-white racial ethnic background. Hawaii has a legacy of sending women of color to the U.S. House and the U.S. Congress. And so I think that there's, and nobody's sort of talking about Hawaii as sort of being unmasculine, right, in any particular way. And so I think there's a way that our partisan ideas are giving us information about gender, and people have very different ideas. You can see the same analogy to the UK or Brazil, where these hegemonic leaders who sort of practice this kind of right-wing braggadocio style of populism have really worn masculinity in their pandemic performance in ways that are different from other male leaders, not just Biden, but think about Trudeau in Canada. So I think there's a way that femininity and masculinity shift depending on the partisan lens, that these things don't have fixed meanings, they're constructed politically by folks, and that we can sort of think about this shifting meaning in terms of other additional variables like partisanship and populism.
When we come back, what are the factors that have led to some governments being more successful than others in managing or eliminating the novel coronavirus? Stay with us. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Why did some countries fare better in their battle against COVID? Is it the nature of leadership? Is it the values of society? Is it something else altogether? Doug Becker continues the exploration.
I'm Doug Becker. So I was thinking this, and perhaps this is a masculine, feminist, ideological, et cetera, but sort of question, but at least one of the distinct differences in leaders is the way in which issues are framed as individual freedom versus sort of collective good or public goods sorts of questions. First, is it fair to say that there really is a gender component behind the individual freedom versus public goods? And, you know, how is this playing out? Leah?
I think that question gets into the six different cultural dimensions that we measured in our paper. Is that what you were going to say too, Gina? Well, I'll take a stab at it and then volley it over to you. So we looked at these six different cultural dimensions that were identified by Geert Hofstede, which is power, distance, and society. So the distinction between to what extent society is relatively egalitarian, or if there are strong power differentials between individuals, the degree to which society is more individualistic or more collectivistic, how strongly people adhere to prescribed gender roles. So if men are expected to behave in hyper-masculine ways and women expected to behave in hyper-feminine ways, or if there's a lot more fluidity between the expectations of gender performance in society, whether or not countries have a short-term or a long-term goal orientation, and then whether or not they practice indulgence or restraint, which is not, I mean, when I heard that or started reading about this the first time, I thought, well, is this like hedonistic versus like conservative? But it's not. It's more the indulgence aspect is to what extent people are taking care of themselves. So this is like the self-care kind of and care for others kind of perspective. And so we find that countries that have less power distance between members of society, where it's more egalitarian, societies that are more collectivist, that think about the public good, that, you know, for example, I wear my mask not to protect me from you, but to protect you from me, right? And vice versa. Or I stay home, you know, and respect the stay-at-home order, the quarantine order for the greater good, even though that's requiring a sacrifice on my freedom of movement, you know, temporarily. So collectivist societies are doing better. Societies where men and women don't have to fulfill strong prescribed gender roles in society, those societies are doing better, where women are not held to ultra-feminine and men are not held to ultra-masculine standards. Countries that have a longer term orientation also do better. Those that are more short term oriented did not do as well. And then those that practice indulgence, so the self-care and the other care, also tend to do better in terms of not having as many COVID-related fatalities. So it really is about these deep cultural values that are society-wide and that are really part of the fabric of the country and the culture that contribute to how well people are doing in those countries. And also, too, thinking about the long term. I mean, right now, you know, we look at four different models. We look at one that looks at cases, the number of cases after 30 days, the number of deaths, and the number of deaths per million at 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, and 120 days. And I think that looking at those four time spans can give us kind of a roadmap for looking forward too, that there's a lot of noise in the data at 30 days because there's no real trend established. There's no pattern. Things are still emerging. And I think that kind of in the big picture, we're still really in the early phases of understanding what the long-term implications of the COVID pandemic are going to be. Now, the trends start to even out at 60, 90, and 120 days. But I think that, you know, looking more long range, if we want to know how societies are going to do, how well they're balanced between these six different cultural dimensions, you know, thinking more long-term than just a really short-term, immediate picture snapshot of how things stand or how things look right now.
Yes, Jennifer Piscopo.
Jumping on this question about sort of collectivism versus individualism and how it might intersect with gender, you know, I think it's all situationally specific, perhaps culturally specific, but, you know, reflecting on the United States case, I think, again, the intersectional analysis where we combine gender with other dimensions is really important. So, you know, our international audience probably knows that we have a lot of folks in the U.S. who are deeply opposed to masking. Some research shows, right, of course, that your opposition to masking in the United States, at least, is sort of correlated with having more hegemonic masculine traits, right? So this association between masculinity and not masking, right, being a brave individual. But I actually think in the U.S. context, too, it's also intersected with race. So in the US context, you know, when I look at people who are against masking, they make all these references to, I don't want to mask because that makes me a sheep, right? And they're making a reference, they're making an anti-collective reference. And their point of reference is, of course, East Asian countries and cultures. And all of the stereotypes that folks in the U.S. have about East Asian countries and culture, that they're collectivist, that they don't act individually, that they can't think for themselves. And in the United States, East Asian immigrants and people with East Asian backgrounds endure a variety of stereotypes that very much feminize East Asian men and women. There's this feminization of Asian migrants and immigrants in the United States. So I think that in the U.S., we see the opposition to masking. It's bound up in race and gender, right? So there's something about this being an individual, being a white individual, that being a white individual is free, right? It's being unencumbered by obligations to other people. And then that's the opposite of being this racialized sort of sheep person who only cares for other people. So again, I think the intersectional analysis is so interesting. I think in the US, the refusal to mask is not just bound up with asserting your gender identity. I think it's bound up with asserting whiteness and all of the ways that East Asians are treated poorly historically in the United States and all those stereotypes of East Asians. Because of course, pre-COVID, whom did you associate with wearing masks all the time? You associated that with East Asians, right? And so I think that's part of what's happening in the dynamics here and why we need to think not just about gender, but again, about how it intersects with these other variables.
Gina Reinhart.
I am absolutely in agreement. I really appreciate you bringing that up, Jennifer, because I think that these intersected traits are much more important than we're giving them credit for. So if we think about masking, we also know that within the US, different subcultures are more collectivist or individualist than others, right? And they tend to be more collectivist along racial or expatriate lines. So a group of Cuban Americans, a group of Korean Americans that have recently immigrated are much more likely to be considering themselves a community to take care of within their community, and that the community advancement is just as important, if not more so, than any individual's advancement, right? Trying to get a foot in the United States and getting established as a community rather than just as an individual. And we also see that these communities are more likely to be wearing masks to take care of themselves and each other. But just like Jennifer pointed out, they are likely to be non-white communities. And that is part of the stereotype as well. These things are getting conflated in people's minds because of what they see and because race and gender are so visibly judged. Whether or not the judgments are accurate or conform to what the actual people being judged would say, they're still judged visually by almost everybody in the world, right? So the other thing to realize is that many of the collectivistic cultures in the world are governed by men right now, and that there are not that many women in charge of countries that are collectivist right now. So in our analysis, just looking at the leadership versus these cultural dimensions, women are much more likely to be leaders of individualist countries and cultures than they are to be leaders of collectivists. And men are much less likely to be leaders of collectivist cultures. Part of that is based on what Jennifer said at the very beginning, which is that there just aren't that many countries right now that are led by women. There are 12. But the other part of it is that it does not appear, at least right now, that collectivist countries are necessarily electing women or promoting women to their highest office.
You know, within particularly empirical research is the problem of N, that you just, since you don't have as many cases, sometimes it's difficult to extrapolate based on your data sets, which of course, I am fully on board with the notion that more than anything, we need to increase the N. So with that in mind, I'll start with Leah Windsor. Now that we are in this second wave of virus outbreaks, and we've seen elections, we've seen responses, what sorts of conclusions would you draw? And you know, if you dare, I know we social scientists hate to put on that predictive hat, but if you dare to predict a bit sort of where we're going with respect to women leadership, feminist ideologies or feminist foundations for government, or any of the intersectionality issues that we raised, where do you think we're headed?
Well, I think that the pandemic has opened up a lot of other conversations as well. So you've seen in the United States this concurrent social movement with Black Lives Matter and the attention to people of color and their, you know, disproportionately violent experiences in society. And, you know, part of that has to do with these political opportunity structures that people are at home, at least in the spring they were, and the cost for participation in terms of missing work or missing school or things like that was comparatively lower. And so I think that the pandemic has also raised the awareness of other kind of social issues that have been bubbling at the surface over the years, but this has really raised, it's really elevated these other issues alongside, you know, in terms of racial justice and equity. I think that in terms of feminine leadership and women's leadership and collectivism and public goods, I think it's a real mixed bag, honestly. You know, in hearing from other friends and colleagues all over the world, Europe is experiencing, you know, a rise in cases on par. I'm not sure if it's the exponential rate that the U.S. is having, the number of COVID cases growing. But there's a fatigue at this point. And, you know, there are real constraints, you know, thinking from a social movement perspective, you know, a lot of the boycotts, there was in South Africa or in the U.S. civil rights movement in the South, the boycotts strategically were released or for lessened, relieved, you know, around holiday times, because it was going to be much harder for people to keep up, you know, not buying holiday gifts or things like that, or going shopping. So I think that we're seeing some real pressures, and, you know, it may be a triumph of messaging for women leaders or for men leaders in more egalitarian societies to appeal to people to continue best practices in public health and socialization and social and physical distancing. You know, we'll just have to see. I mean, it's I don't know that I have a real rosy picture at this point. You know, things are looking kind of dire right now.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about managing and eliminating the coronavirus and what has led to some countries' success and other countries' failures.
Courtney Burns, where do you think we're headed?
I think Leah did a nice job of kind of painting a perhaps not rosy picture at the moment. I do think that in terms of leadership and responses to COVID-19, I think that there could be a switch to focusing on the individual. That could be, or at least that could be a potential avenue of change, where if it looked like the government actually cared for you as a person — this is actually a very feminist policy to implement, is that you, the person, matter to us, the government. And so whether that be the ability to pass more stimulus checks to help, but this idea that individuals matter. So I think that that could be a turn that could be good in terms of responding to this. And we'll have to wait and see though, because in at least here in the United States, with a shift in leadership, we may see that shift in responses.
Yes, Leah Windsor.
Something that I'd love to tee up, Gina, I don't know if you're already thinking about this, Gina, but there may be a backlash as well. So there are a number of examples worldwide of leaders opportunistically using COVID restrictions to clamp down on various forms of social protest or political engagement or collective action, or not even just suppressing that, but overt repression. So using the, under the cover of COVID, doing more authoritarian behavior. So Gina, I know you've thought probably more about this than I have.
Gina Reinhart, your response.
Well, unfortunately, my outlook is not particularly rosy about it either. I think that we, as a world society, we tend to swing like a pendulum. And in response to this shock that some of us saw coming, a lot, almost everybody else, right? Nobody saw. I think that the instinct is going to be to curl up in a ball and shut down, and that a lot, this is really going to fuel a populism among a lot of countries. People that are definitely happy to be isolationist are going to be even happier to be isolationist. And countries that are prone, leaders that are prone to taking away people's rights, have taken them away quite reasonably in this context, certainly in accord with the International Charter on Human Rights, but without any measures in place as to when those are going to be reviewed, how long they're going to be taken away, when they might be reinstated. And it's going to be a really great opportunity for a lot of people to push things to a very regulated, very isolationist status and not leave it.
And Jennifer Piscopo, I'll give you the last word. Where do you think we're headed?
So we've talked a lot about sort of cultural norms in different communities and different countries and different places around the globe. But I also want to come back to parties and to institutions, thinking both about the pandemic and women's leadership. So, you know, again, right now where we see women chief executives is in these global North countries that have strong institutions. They have strong bureaucracies, they have impartial justice systems, they have really well-functioning welfare sectors. And importantly, women have come to power in these contexts in programmatic parties. So when political scientists talk about programmatic parties, they mean parties that are really organized on different principles related to policy, and parties that are not sort of organized on just making populist appeals that are sort of us versus them, but are really devoid of any policy content. Now, historically, women actually came to power through populist or patronage-based parties, especially in the global south. But I think what's happening right now, and this is before the pandemic, is that right now, many populist and patronage-based parties are also right parties. So you can have a populist party, it could be of the left or of the right. But I think as populism and patronage becomes more ideologically right, you know, that's foreclosing upon opportunities for women. And that's why we see women getting elected in countries that are still pursuing programmatic routes, that still have programmatic parties, and that those are vehicles for women's election. Right, so I'm thinking again about the kind of populism you see evinced by Donald Trump, by Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, by Duterte in the Philippines, this kind of hegemonically masculine right-leaning populism. Why does that matter for the pandemic? Well, I think the question is going to be, as Gina was saying, is which way do countries start to pull? Does the kind of fear and isolation of the pandemic make voters more likely to choose populist parties, as Gina was suggesting. But I think there might be some reason for optimism. I mean, certainly in the United States, right, there was an overwhelming decision, both by voters in the popular vote and by what will become electors in the Electoral College, to go back to programmatic policymaking as evidenced by the Democratic Party, as evidenced by Joe Biden. I think you're seeing this in other places in Latin America where there's actually been quite a rejection, except for Brazil, but there's actually been quite a rejection of sort of right-leaning and or populist leaders. You see citizens taking to the streets in places like Chile, in places like Peru, despite the pandemic, to demand the kind of institutional performance that many people in global north countries like Scandinavia and Western Europe already enjoy. So I think there might be some reasons for skepticism, but I think there might be some reasons for optimism, because it's really been state capacity, the strength of institutions, that's allowed countries to mount effective coronavirus responses. And when I think voters recognize that, now they might not, right? There's a lot of Trump voters in the United States who haven't figured this out. But when voters recognize that, I think there'll be a demand again for good governance. But I think the real lesson is that voters have to demand good governance. When voters demand good governance, they can be protected, cared for, their lives can be saved. When they don't, right, you end up with red states in the United States, Brazil, Mexico, places governed by leaders that have not invested in good governance and that have shockingly awful COVID mortality rates. And I think that's a really key lesson here.
So we'll end on an optimistic note, rare for the COVID era and rare for the year 2020. Thank you very much to our guests. Our guests have been Leah Windsor, Research Assistant Professor in the Institute of Intelligent Systems at the University of Memphis. She is the author of Language of Radicalization, Female Internet Recruitment to Participation in ISIS Activities. Gina Yanitel-Reinhardt. She is the Associate Professor of Government at the University of Essex in the UK and the author of The Intersectionality of Disaster's Effects on Trust in Public Officials. Jennifer Piscopo, Associate Professor of Politics at Occidental College and the author of Women Leaders in Pandemic Performance, A Spurious Correlation. And Courtney Burns, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Bucknell University and the author of Signaling Woman and Leader, Navigating the Double Bind as Foreign Policy Decision Maker. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.